Okay. My name is Pat Slora, and I'm the District 1 Archives Chairman. And would you identify yourself?
Yes, my name is Lucille Pruitt.
Okay.
My dry date is October
17, 1956. Okay. Could you tell me a little bit about how you got yourself to AA and, you know, sort of tell your story a little bit?
Well, I had a lot of help. I was periodic, and I had just been on, the periods got longer, of course. And I had just been on a drinking, running kind of thing for about 6 months. And when I realized that I had to do something about my drinking, I went back to my mother-in-law's home in Big Springs, Texas. I didn't know anything about AA, and I didn't know anything about drying out places, hospital treatment, anything like that. I, of course, looked at my drinking as a character defect. I couldn't quite understand how it could happen to me because I'd always been a strong character in my eyes, you know. So I figured that the way you quit drinking was you just quit and gritted your teeth and clenched your fists and that. Of course, I'd tried that before. I'd also tried my church. I'd always gone to church except when I was drinking. So I'd go back to church, but then I'd get drunk again. And I hear a lot of talk about non-alcoholics not being able to help us, but that's not what I found the case to be. My mother-in-law was totally deaf, and I had told her I had to quit drinking when I came in, and I didn't take a drink for 9 days or so. And of course, I was walking the floor and sweating and crying and wringing my hands and saying, I can't do this, but I didn't take a drink. When I said I can't do this, I meant I couldn't not drink, but I didn't drink for those days. And I didn't know it, but she had been talking to a neighbor who had a friend who was in AA. The neighbor was not alcoholic, neither was my mother-in-law. So she talked to the neighbor, and the neighbor had to do her phoning for her since she couldn't hear. And they decided to call the friend of the neighbor's who had been sober 20 years and was an AA member. He was 81 years old. And they called him to talk to him about me. And he asked him if I had asked for help, and they said, no, but she's not drinking. He said, you will know when to ask her. And if she says yes, of course we will come. So really, I got in contact with AA through the efforts of two non-alcoholics. And this old man was blind with cataracts almost. He couldn't drive. So my mother-in-law, one day I was sitting at the table knowing that I had to have a drink, hating myself for what I had to do, and realizing that if I did take that drink, the probabilities were almost nil that I would ever try to sober up again because it had been too hard. And while I was sitting there putting it off, knew I was going to town to get a drink, but putting it off as long as I could, my mother-in-law asked me, or she said to me, you really want to stop drinking, don't you? I said, yeah, but I don't think I can. Well, I wasn't very honest because I already knew I couldn't. So it was at that time she asked me if I would talk to somebody from AA, if they would come out, and I said, yes, I'll talk to them, but I don't think they can help me. I don't think anybody can. I didn't have any hope at all, really. So this non-alcoholic neighbor, my mother-in-law went to talk to her, and they called this man. They called Uncle Jimmy. And he made arrangements for... Yeah, they're gone. He made arrangements for the non-alcoholic neighbor to pick him up and pick me up. So he took us out to where the meetings were held. They owned their own little building out there.
This was in the mid-50s, right?
This is 1956, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, he must have been one of the early members then.
No, he wasn't. He'd been sober 20 years, but the first 10 years of his sobriety, he did it the white knuckle way.
Oh, I see.
He found out about AA later through some friends and started going and loved it.
Uh-huh.
And said his sobriety was so much more comfortable,
uh-huh.
You know, after he started, became involved in AA. So he really wasn't an early member of AA. I suppose he came in the 40s.
Yeah, that was pretty early, though, really.
Yeah, 46.
Yeah.
He must have come in about 46, because he'd been sober since 36.
Yeah.
He was a retired railroad man, very interesting man, I thought.
Yeah.
But anyway, they took me out, and then that night, he gave me some pamphlets to read, talked to me a little bit, and asked if I wanted to go to the meeting that night, and I said yes. And this same non-alcoholic lady picked us both up and took us to the meeting. She sat on one side of me, he on the other, and of course I was shaking like a leaf.
Uh-huh.
So they sat there holding my hands all during that meeting. I've often said to keep me from growing through the roof, you know. But that's how I got into AA in Big Spring.
Did they accept you right away into the fellowship? I know some people, one fellow I know from St. Louis was not able to get right into the fellowship because...
Why not?
Well, they had a beginners meeting for the beginners, and they were kept in one room, and they were instructed in the steps and whatnot by one of the old-timers. And if the old-timer felt that he was, you know, that they were sincere and that they were ready, they could present a life history in writing to the committee who had to approve of it. Yeah, and he says he's a card-carrying member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he is. He's got the card with the stars on it. I think he's got 38 years of sobriety now. He knew Father Ed Dowling and all that.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah.
No, I was totally surrounded, mostly by men.
I was wondering if there are many women then.
Yeah, there's so many things I hear in AA, and even things that's said in the big book, you know. Now, it may have been modified, too. I don't remember reading it at that time, although I certainly read the big book right away. I think it says in the big book now, let the men sponsor the men and the women sponsor the women.
Right, uh-huh.
That probably wasn't, I don't even know if that was in the
Oh, no, that wasn't in the big book because the word sponsor isn't mentioned in the big book.
Well, it may not say sponsor. There's something in the big book about the men taking care of the men and women the women. But I don't think there was anything like that in the original edition, which, by the way, I don't have now. I had the first edition when I started out.
Yeah.
But there was never any thought of that because although they were bringing in patients from the state hospital there to the meetings, and there was some controversy in the group about that, but there were women that came in with them, but they really weren't active or oftentimes went back to their hometown or whatever, and there was really only one woman who was a member of that group, and she rarely came. She was a cook out at the state hospital, but her husband was one of my sponsors. And I was just totally surrounded by warmth and support, and of course, you know, I was considered at that time a little iffy, because I was so young.
Uh-huh.
They thought I might be too young to be an alcoholic, although they never told me simply because of the way I behaved.
Uh-huh.
And my physical condition when I came in. But it's laughable now because we have so many young people in AA, and I was 36 years old when I came in. But the next man, the next member closest to me in age was 56.
My goodness.
So you see, I was a lot younger than they were. But they were great 12-steppers. They taught me so much about 12-stepping and that kind of thing. And they started taking me right away. They'd say, you know, just sit back and watch what we're doing. And keep your mouth shut. Well, that was no problem. I didn't have anything to say anyway.
Yeah.
But they started me on 12-step calls. If they got a 12-step call, they'd say, let's go. And, of course, it was nice. They were glad to have a woman because women would call, and they felt like it'd be nice to have both a man and a woman to call on people.
Right.
Anybody.
Yeah.
But when I think about sponsoring, I only had men sponsors, although I was became very good friends with this lady who was a member.
Mm-hmm.
But when I look back on it, I'd always been a daddy's girl. I always turned to my father for guidance. It would have been and was the most natural thing in the world for me to turn to men for guidance.
Yeah. Right.
You know, I wasn't crazy about my mother. I was scared of her anyway, and it bothered me, and I didn't like her way of giving advice, I guess, or guidance. So if they had tried to turn me over to a woman, it's highly unlikely I ever would have gone back.
Yeah.
And I was in AA for a few years, all 3 to 5 years, and began, and as other women came into the group, I really learned to appreciate women and, of course, have lots of women friends now. But I guess it doesn't make too much difference who brings you in or brings you along.
Right. The important thing is the results, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Of course, they did terrible things to me, like find me a job and work and all that kind of thing, you know.
Yeah, you probably were praying for a man with money and they found your job.
That's right. Well, I was married at the time.
Yeah.
Although I had run off and left my husband in New Mexico, he didn't even know where I was. But he was drinking, too, he and his brother. I couldn't quit drinking if I was around them. So ran off to his mother's house.
Yeah.
And I didn't let him know where I was till I got in contact with AA.
Yeah.
Then he came. And he came to his first meeting 17 days after I made my first meeting.
Ah.
He stayed sober 4 years and 10 months and drank again, but only for a week, or one night or something. And then he went back to AA and stayed sober 18 months.
Mm-hmm.
Started drinking again in 62 and has never been able to get off of it again. He's warehoused somewhere, either in a VA domiciliary or a nursing home now. I lost track of him in 1972.
Yeah.
But the VA tells me he's still living. But
my
they won't
goodness.
Give me his address or anything.
Yeah.
I know that most of his family has died since that time, and I certainly would, you know, help him any way I could. But I really don't know where he is. So I wrote him a letter last year, and the VA mailed it to him, they said, but I've had no reply.
Wonder why they wouldn't let you know where he was.
Well, it's a matter of confidentiality. I don't know. I'm still married to him.
Yeah.
So it looks like they're giving me his address, but they have their rules, you know, whatever it is. So I haven't had an answer, but they assure me that he's still alive. See, I started getting reports that he had died.
Uh-huh.
And it was kind of unfinished business. I wanted to know.
Yeah.
So I went to the VA. I had his claim number. I went to the VA and told them the situation and that it was unfinished business, and I just wanted to know. So they assured me he was still alive. But I got his reports, hospital reports, from San Antonio, Texas, the state hospital there, from, two, three, and four, and it was, they were not. Now, they released that information, but they had transferred him to a nursing home, and when my lawyer tried to find him or call that nursing home, there was no trace of it. And he said that the operators around San Antonio did everything they could. They gave him a supervisor who went back 5 years looking for the name of that nursing home. And she said, well, it's been closed more than 5 years. So that's where we lost track of it.
Yeah.
So I'm, you know, we're always sorry. But that's the way it goes. We don't all make it, right?
Right. Was it difficult for you when he would go back to drinking? What did you do at that time when he would go
back?
Well,
the first time, you know, it seems to me that we're drunk before we take a drink.
Mm-hmm.
And he had been for about 6 weeks really off the wall. And so I talked to him about it, and I said, you know, I realized that we met in a bar. We drank together for 2 years. And we didn't really know each other. And it seems to me that an unfair burden for you to be stuck with a wife that you met while you were drinking, and then you get sobered up. After a few years, your needs may very well change.
Uh-huh.
And I'm comfortable with the idea that you should have your freedom if you want it. And he said, I think we should separate. He didn't say he wanted his freedom, but he thought we should separate. So I left and went to Lubbock, Texas to some friends and got a job there. And he drank. I think what I was doing was interfering with his drinking at that point.
Uh-huh.
He drank, if not that weekend, then very soon afterwards. And then he came to see me in Lubbock and told me what had happened, and that he realized that all the things he had hung on me were not my fault, and that he'd like me to come home.
Uh-huh.
So I went. And he did. I didn't do well at all. It was strange after that. I went through a dry drunk or something after he got, you know, after all that happened. I functioned very well.
Uh-huh.
When I got back up to Farmington, New Mexico, I really went through some strange head trips. Finally, a friend of mine, a woman in AA, came over and banged on my door and said, I wasn't answering the door.
Uh-huh.
Let me in there. I know you're in there, you know.
Uh-huh.
And I let her in, and she spent the rest of the day with me and listened to all my craziness and kind of got me back on the track. Now, 18 months later, we were living in Gallup, New Mexico, and I was director of the Alcoholism Information and Referral Center at the Gallup Indian Community Center.
Uh-huh.
And he was working for the Navajo tribe as a surveyor, party chief for them. So he was gone 5 days a week out on the reservation, and I lived in town in Gallup. He came in on the weekend. But 18 months after that, he started this same behavior pattern of everything was wrong and it was all my fault and all that kind of stuff. And I realized he was going to drink again, and I realized there was nothing I could do about it. I also realized that I would never live with him again because I couldn't afford, mentally or any other way, to have my life turned over every 18 months.
Right, yeah.
You know,
right.
I just couldn't do it. So I never lived with him again, but I didn't divorce him.
Yeah.
I didn't have any reason to. I liked him, and I was not mad at him, and that's when I became convinced that there are some who drink because they can't do anything else.
Yeah.
I got over that judgmental, you know, you had a choice and all that business, because I'm not was comfortable with that.
Yeah.
But of course, I was in touch with him then, closely in touch for the first year after that. He was stabbed in a barroom brawl about 2 months after he started drinking. And so they called me. This was back in Farmington. I was in Gallup, and they didn't expect him to live, and he was not doing well, and the doctor said he was dying because he didn't want to live, and the AA members there thought maybe I could perk him up or something. Anyway, I went. And I went with him in the ambulance into Albuquerque to the VA hospital. And the way it turned out, he only knew me the last 4 days that I was in Albuquerque, so... and he wanted to come home. And I wouldn't let him do that. So a year later, he called me or would come by about every 3 months. Still drinking. And a year later, he had a real bad car wreck out on the one of the Apache reservations, a different, further from home, at Tierra Amarilla. Out that direction in New Mexico.
Was he Indian himself?
Well, he was, but he was Cherokee and Choctaw. He was also Scotch and German. And his mother and father were both registered Indians in the, in Oklahoma. He was not a, but he was not one of the nomadic tribes. But I think maybe some of his problems were that half-breeds were not, well, they were, I guess they're still discriminated against, and I think it caused certain, oh, maybe problems that he was not able to deal with. Maybe if he'd had some professional help, I just don't know. But he was really a bright person and good, gentle. I've often wondered why I would stay sober and he wouldn't. Because he was far more compassionate than I. He worked as hard at the program as I did, if, at least at the surface. You know, made meetings, 12-step calls, and washed cups, and did everything I did. And smarter. And what else might I say? He appeared to want to be sober as much as I did. It's just a big question mark to me why I would stay sober and was not able to. But maybe someday we'll have the answers to those things, but we don't have them yet. As far as I've been able to determine. So that's the way that turned out.
When did you come to Florida?
I came to Florida in 1967. Now, I've done a lot of traveling since I quit drinking and since I haven't been married. My job in Gallup, my salary was paid by the Unitarian Service Committee, and they go in and they have a 10-year contract in any town where they're helping with service centers and things like that, hospitals or whatever it is they agree to help with. So I worked the last 3 years of the contract. So then my job ended. And I went to San Francisco, and I stayed out there about 14 months, and I decided to go to the Hawaiian Islands. And I went over there and stayed a year. And since I was sober, I wanted to see some of the world, you know. When I was drinking, I'd get stuck in a bar. I couldn't get any place, hardly, not even to my best friend's wedding, which I've never been forgiven for. And I lived in Chicago a while, and then I met some people, the two you'll interview. Or at least I know Lucy Bell will be calling you. I told her I was going to call you. I met her and her husband in San Francisco. And we all three went to the Hawaiian Islands. So when I got back over here, we became good friends over, you know, a couple of years' time. And I was in Chicago about 3 months, and we had a terrible blizzard, and I wasn't used to that kind of weather, and I called her, and I said, I'll be on the next plane. So that's how I happened to come down here.
Yeah.
And then sometime later, I went to work as a rehabilitation counselor for Goodwill, and I was out there 7 years. And I worked a year and a half or something like that at the Tampa Area Council on Alcoholism.
Uh-huh.
And then I, when I left there, I went to California and I worked at the Women's Alcoholism Service Center in Oakland.
Uh-huh.
For a year. And so, I don't know, I've just had a great time and met a lot of interesting people and done things that make me feel good.
Have you seen a lot of differences in AA, different places where you've been, different customs and things like that, or over the years that you've been in AA?
Well, yes, of course, I have. I never will forget the first meeting I made where they read the first part of the fifth chapter.
Uh-huh.
And I'd been sober about 4.5 years, and I was in sin. That was no way to run an AA meeting, you know.
Yeah.
So in West Texas, they give their dry day when they introduce themselves.
Uh-huh.
And I still do that once in a while. I think it serves a good purpose. And anyway, it's the way I was trained. You're very likely to do, you know, stay with what worked for you.
Right.
If you want to stay sober, that is.
Right.
So they give their dry dates. And, but they don't read, and they read the preamble, of course. But they don't read the fifth chapter around in West Texas, but over the line into northern New Mexico or western New Mexico, they do.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, in California, they do.
Yeah.
And I see places who keep no records of any kind, and I see others who keep records. And in my hometown in Midland, Texas, where I grew up, on your birthday, they didn't do this when I was there 25 years ago.
Uh-huh.
But they give a little card which states that you're a member of AA in good standing with so many years of sobriety.
Yeah.
Which I find kind of interesting.
Yeah.
So, yes, they do it differently, but basically, the direction certainly appears to be the same.
Right.
There are some... Now, down here, you know, with the Agape groups, their focus is still sobriety.
Uh-huh.
But they work it a little differently.
Right. Are they just mostly in Florida, the Agape groups, or are they all over?
Well, they're the only ones I've run into, but I'm sure they're in other places. And there are some Agape members here who probably can tell you about that.
Uh-huh.
You want me to have one of them call you?
Sure, yeah, that'd be great, because
okay.
That is kind of different.
I'm thinking about who I'll talk to, but I'll find one and get them to call you, if I can find one who has a little background on it.
Yeah, that would be real good.
Yeah, let me find out if I can.
I'd like to know how it got started and, you know,
yeah,
things like
too.
That.
I really don't know, you know.
Uh-huh.
And then there are places where they have meetings that are almost like seances, which are a little...
Oh, no, I've never been to one of those. Yeah.
Those were in Miami. Now, whether they have them here, I don't know. There was one candlelight meeting here, but I don't know. I never did go.
Uh-huh.
And whether they're still having that, I'll have to find out for you.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
I knew the woman who started those. But I never did go to a meeting.
Yeah.
And I don't know if they're still having them, although I know she's still around. So I'll call her and ask her.
Oh, that's great.
What's going on?
Yeah.
And, but most of the places, like the first group I ever went to, the people who felt the program was a spiritual program, and those who felt it dealt more with physical and mental problems,
uh-huh,
or, you know, the agnostics or the atheists, or whatever bent they were just integrated, and they got along okay.
Right, yeah.
I've seen some places where those who were highly spiritual really and truly tried to freeze out those who did not go along with their beliefs.
Right.
But that doesn't last.
Now, Jimmy Burwell was, you know, one. He was agnostic, and they...
Know, we talked to him in California before he died.
Oh.
And although he said that he was atheist.
Yeah.
He meant AA, that he was always atheist and that he had never changed. That's what he told us 2 or 3 years before he died.
Oh, well, the tape that I have, he said he did change, and it was from out in California. I can't remember. It was in 1958. When did you see him?
Well, this was more like in the 60s.
Well, maybe he changed his mind again.
Well, that's what I tell people. I say, look, what I'm saying tonight from this podium is my opinion right now, and I reserve the right to say something different tomorrow without being chastised for it, you know?
Uh-huh.
Because without changing our minds, how do we grow?
Right.
So it's very possible that he realized, maybe, that he hadn't really changed. I don't know.
Some of the things that he said on the tape, I sort of questioned, you know? Like he said at the time that the Big Book was written, there were only 8 of them that had more than 6 months of sobriety.
Well, that's true.
Now, oh, isn't that something? And also... He was, oh boy, what else was it? He said that there was a man that had a wet brain that was released from a mental institution who named the Big Book, named the Society of Alcoholics Anonymous, named it Alcoholics Anonymous, and that right after he suggested that name, then he got real bad again because they said he wouldn't be able to be out long, and he went back mental institution, he said nowhere in that first edition of the Big Book does it mention the name of the fellowship as being Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have a copy of the pre-publication Multilith copy that they sent, the 400 that they sent out to different people.
Mm-hmm.
And it does talk about it as being our Society of Alcoholics Anonymous, especially in that chapter, A Vision for You. But I wondered if that they might have changed that, because I have seen reprints of the preamble. Say they'd say it was from like 1940 some, and it did not have Honest Desire in it.
Well, and it had Honest Desire in it when I came in.
Yeah. Well, now in Ozona, we still use that. The Honest Desire.
And I was so glad when they dropped it.
Uh-huh.
They must have dropped that in 57 or somewhere.
58. Uh-huh.
Oh, I knew it was somewhere in there.
Uh-huh.
But every time, you know, I was so upshook and nervous and so fragile as far as my hold on sobriety. And my body, not my head, but my body wanted to drink every waking moment and sometimes in my sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they'd say the only requirement for membership is an honest desire to stay sober, I didn't know whether I qualified or not, because it seemed to me that I had a very tenuous hold on that.
Yeah.
And then they dropped that.
Right.
And it was such a relief to me personally.
Right.
And I still kind of worried about it. And then a man got up and he said, as long as I want to stay sober more than I want to drink.
Yeah.
That gave me a great insight. I thought I was the only one who wanted to drink even though they were staying sober.
Yeah.
And so I felt dishonest, you know, and I wondered what was wrong with me and all that. Of course, I understand it better now.
Yeah.
But when he said, as long as I want to stay sober more than I want to drink, I knew that he wanted to drink sometimes.
Yeah.
Which relieved me a lot of, you know, the whole thing. So I was glad when they dropped that.
Well, I know that...
I don't think it has to be
long as you're willing to do is, you know, what you have to stay sober,
yeah,
you know.
But you only have to want it as much as you can.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, if you hurt so bad that you think you just can't get by without a drink, how strong can your desire to stay sober be?
Yeah. Well,
it'll suffice, of course, as long as you got lots of support around.
Yeah. I came into the Ozona group. That was my first meeting. And they scared me into
Willow, good. Whatever,
yeah,
works.
Whatever it takes, boy. I knew they'd know if I drank again, so I never did.
Hang on just a minute, will you?
Okay.
Can you turn the tape recorder off?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay, let's see, what else did I want to ask you? Have you been involved in the service structure of AA at all? Have you served?
No, I never have been at that. I have to think about this because I've been involved with so much.
Uh-huh.
No, not at that level. It seemed to me like that with my working in the field,
right?
That it was better to let other people do the other things, but my agency work with them.
Uh-huh.
You understand what I'm saying?
Right. I think this is pretty common with people that are professionals in the field. Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Well, for one thing, you want to involve as many people as you can. You just get a better product.
Uh-huh.
So I've never been in any of the offices.
Have you been to the conventions and whatnot?
You mean just the AA convention?
Uh-huh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. The best convention in the world, I think, is probably Top Texas in Amarillo, Texas.
Yeah.
They really put it on top shelf. I love that convention.
I had heard good things about one that's held in Midland. That you mentioned.
Midland, Texas?
Mm-hmm. I met a couple of doctors from there at a seminar. And, of course, maybe that's why they said it was so great, because they were from there.
Well,
I can't remember. I can only remember her first name is Virginia.
Oh, yeah, I know who they are.
Yeah, she's not an alcoholic.
No, she's a good Al-Anon.
Right. Uh-huh.
And she is my mother's podiatrist.
Yeah, that's what they are. They're podiatrists, yeah.
Yeah. Well, now, don't forget that I was sober 2.5 years. I moved from Big Springs to Midland. I stayed there maybe a year or so, and then we went back to New Mexico.
Uh-huh.
And except for going home for visits, I have not lived in Midland since that time. Of course, I always go to meetings, still got a lot of old friends there.
Uh-huh.
In the group. Well, there's more than one group, but in the group I go to. And I'm sure that they do have a lot of things that I don't know about now.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So.
Well, how did you know Jimmy Burwell? From just listening to him talk, or did you know him personally?
No. These friends that I'm telling you about, he's been sober 38 years.
Uh-huh.
And they're curious in the way you are.
Uh-huh.
And they go and seek these people out.
Uh-huh.
Or they go to the central office, or, you know, they just are seekers.
Uh-huh.
Very much as you are, and that's how you find them.
Yeah.
And that's how they found him.
Wow.
So, that's, you know, one that I tell you, yeah, that was in the 60s, early 60s sometime.
Uh-huh.
That they talked to him.
Yeah. Wonder if they put that on tape or anything.
I don't know.
Because that tape I found tremendously interesting. And I remember saying that at a meeting at the time the big book was written. There were only 8 people that had been sober less than 6 months. And a couple people got really excited about that. And I thought, well, maybe he just exaggerated, you know. But
no, I don't think so. If you read the stuff that Bill wrote many years later, you find a lot of stuff. Two things that have happened, as happened in almost any fellowship or anything, any organization, any movement,
uh-huh.
is that history gets distorted.
Right.
glad you're doing this, because I told Lucy earlier, I said, well, the older AA gets, and as we die off, the more distorted history's going to be, so the cleaner she can get it,
yeah,
the better. And I know of one time when Bill Wilson, I have heard a tape of it, at some meeting, in New York, and he walked in and they all stood up and started clapping and wanting him to speak and all that. And almost as if he were real tired, he said, I wish you people would let me become an AA member.
Yes, I have
heard
that.
We want them to be bigger than life. And they were just like us. They were people with problems and weaknesses, and they struggled to get sober and stay sober. And they weren't that different from us.
Right, yeah. I agree with that. And Jimmy Burwell.
Think of them as AA members. That's
yeah, right. I think so too. Jimmy Burwell said that they were all just a bunch of cranks. You know, they were trying to do the best they could with what they had.
Well, you know, at one point, Bill wrote something about, I look back over the babblings of a madman who for 7 years had daily contemplated suicide. He was sober all that time.
Uh-huh.
I think you'll find that somewhere, either in AA Comes of Age or that book, what they call that book they put together at the Long Beach International Convention in 59. Do you have that?
I sure don't. I hadn't heard of that one.
Okay. They put together, and I've lost my copy.
Ah.
I'm sorry to say. They put together all the addresses that were made at that international convention. And I didn't get to go to that convention, but I had friends in Farmington, Mexico, who went and they taped everything. They brought them back, and I got to listen to all the tapes.
Wow.
And Bill, and when they got, that may be in there, but if you read the things that Bill wrote as the years went on,
uh-huh.
He was very plain about, you know, the things that happened.
Yes. Yeah.
He was a very unhappy. He was just like the rest of us.
Right. Yeah.
And that comes through in his later writings, you know.
Yeah, I think AA Comes of Age is very plain in what it says. It just tells everything. It doesn't paint a real rosy picture. It paints it the way it happened.
Well, Bill, at least, didn't want to do that. He didn't want to mislead us or pretend to be something he wasn't.
Right.
Dr. Bob, I don't know, you know.
Yeah.
Because, first place, I didn't have very much access to any of his. You know, they broke off. They were very much into the absolutes around Akron.
Oh, I know. I have some of those early pamphlets. They're really something.
They scared hell out of me is what they did.
Yeah.
I couldn't do that.
Yeah.
So it was a long time before AA, the two factions, got together as we are today, you know.
Right.
So I don't know how Bob felt about it, but Bill very plainly did not want to be set apart from the fellowship. And he couldn't keep us from doing it.
Yeah.
I remember one time we were at a meeting in Big Springs and somebody got up and said, as far as I'm concerned, Bill Wilson was just another drunk. And you know, that made my husband so angry.
Oh, boy.
Because he put him on a pedestal.
Yeah.
You know, like Jesus Christ and all that.
Yeah. Well, I know that they would say, introduce him as our beloved Bill, and will everybody rise, please, you know. Matt, I have that on a tape.
That.
Yeah.
So he's just a pretty ordinary guy.
Yeah, did you ever hear him speak?
Only on those tapes from Long Beach.
Yeah.
And I wish I had copies of that. There were a lot of great speakers at that. That was 59.
Okay, well, I'll look in my tape catalog. I probably could order those.
If you can, well, these people from Farmington taped it. Now, whether somebody did it professionally, I don't know.
I imagine they
did. But there's a book.
Oh.
That has all the speeches in it.
Hmm.
And you can probably get that from the central office.
Because
I can't remember the name of it. Lucy Bell may remember the name of it.
Okay.
She may even have a copy of it. I don't know. She's got enough books in storage to fill a library.
Yeah.
So I will talk to her about that. I'll tell her some of your concerns before she calls you. Then she can have some of it together, maybe.
Oh, that would be great. Yeah. And any copies of anything, too, that, you know, she would be willing to copy for us. I don't like to ask people to donate stuff to the archives because I feel like I don't like to give my stuff up. But if I can get copies of it so that the information can be made available to the fellowship, I think is the big thing.
Well, sure.
You know?
I'll tell you something else. How old are you?
I'm 43.
Okay. When you get to be 63,
yeah,
you'll begin to think, where is this information going to be when I'm not around?
Yeah.
Where we are, see?
Yeah.
I'm 64, she's 67, Pappy's 75.
Yeah.
And we have to think about what's going to happen if we're going to leave any legacy at all.
Yeah.
Of course, it'll be in the people that we've supported through the years, I suppose. But she's more apt to give things up.
Yeah.
She did an interesting survey one time.
Oh, really?
Yeah, just on her own. She does these things on her own.
Oh.
She put together a survey, and they went across the country, and she interviewed 300 AA members who had returned to drinking after long-term sobriety.
My goodness.
And then had got back in AA.
Wow.
And when she got back to Miami, she had 298 of those cards that she'd made up filled out.
Yeah.
And she said, oh, so she interviewed 298. She'd made 300 cards.
Mm-hmm.
And then she counted everything up. And what she came up with was a pattern of what leads us back to drinking.
Oh, my goodness.
And you'll find that kind of interesting.
Oh,
she
yeah.
She probably still has that.
Is this Lucy that you're talking
yeah.
about?
Yeah. Oh, Miss Lucy Bell, B-E-L-L,
oh.
is her middle name.
Oh.
And she'll give you her last name if she wants to.
Okay.
But
oh,
she has
my.
A lot of interesting stuff. She's far a better librarian than I would ever be because I won't be burdened with the books and the papers and all that stuff in my moving around, you know.
Yeah.
Incidentally, I'm going to move back to Texas in June.
Oh, my goodness.
I decided to go home.
Well, I'm glad I got to interview you before you left.
Yeah.
My goodness.
What other things are you interested in that I might not have covered?
Well, it was mostly, you know, the way AA is different, how it's changed.
Not a bleeding deacon. I realize that change is the one thing we can count on.
Right, yeah.
But one of these, I'll call you back when I feel fresh and can talk some more.
Okay. Oh, very much, yeah.
Some of the things changes I've observed.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I sure do appreciate you calling. This has been wonderful.
I've just loved it.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad you're doing it, too.
Well, I really enjoy it. It's been wonderful for me.
Sure.
Yeah.
It's a fine thing to do while you're staying sober.
Yeah. Yeah, it sure is. And I'll look forward to Lucy Bell's call then.
Okay.
That'll be wonderful. And your call again, too.
Yes, I'll call you again, Pat.
Okay.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.